This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Accidental Heroes by Danielle Steele. Narrated by Jim Frangione. The author begins with the following note. Dear friends, Accidental Heroes was an exciting and challenging book to write because the action and interactions happen on so many levels. It is inspired by and reminiscent of some of the challenges of traveling today. And at the same time, it is reassuring because it reminds us of how many agencies are involved to safeguard us when we travel. Mishaps can happen anywhere. You can slip in the bathtub at home, too, or trip over your dog when you take him for a walk. But from the time we enter the security lines at any airport, which seems so annoying as we take off our shoes, get slowed down as we wrestle other passengers for plastic bins to put our belongings in, we forget that those security measures are there for our safety, not just to annoy us, and that they do protect us from untoward things happening. And beyond that, there is airport security watching what goes on in the entire airport, Homeland Security and all the federal agencies, and highly trained people under that umbrella who are actually like guardian angels, unseen by us, watching over us even before we take off, during our flights, and until we leave the airport, when we reach our destination. It really is reassuring. And in the case of something unexpected happening, or even suspected, it is fascinating to know how many agencies and skilled people are involved to solve the mystery and the problem before something happens. That's good to remember, too. I was fascinated by the different personalities involved with the characters in the book. The very, very capable senior Homeland Security agent at JFK Airport, whose confidence has been shaken by a recent incident, so he has to get it right this time. The psychiatrist, who helps evaluate situations. The young female agent with multiple degrees but little experience. The young TSA agent, a single mother, who follows her instincts and is smart enough and brave enough to do so. Passengers, police, federal agents, the fantastic female ex-Air Force pilot, the crew, and the passengers on the plane. I also wanted to honor the fact that we never know how we will react to unusual situations. The meekest among us can turn out to have the courage of a lion, and in the toughest of times, we draw on resources we didn't even know we had. Many of us turn out to be accidental heroes when we least expect it. I hope you'll enjoy the people you meet in this book, and the events that unfold as a network of people do their jobs with remarkable skill. Have a great time reading. Love, Danielle Steele. To my wonderful, very special children, Beatty, Trevor, Todd, Nick, Sam, Victoria, Vanessa, Max, and Zara. You are my heroes, and always will be. Bravely facing the challenges that have confronted us with poise and dignity, courage and grace. You have my love and admiration, always and forever. I love you so much. Mom/DS. Chapter 1. Bernice Adams woke up, as she usually did, just before the alarm went off, so she didn't wake her 6-year-old son, Toby. Some maternal instinct pulled her out of her dreams before the buzzer sounded. She smiled as she looked at him sleeping next to her in the queen-sized bed that had been a lucky find in a second-hand furniture store. She'd bought a new mattress for it that they had tried out together, and Toby said it felt like a cloud. It was a stretch for their budget, but she decided it was worth it. Toby needed to get to school rested so he could pay attention and do well. She wanted him to have every advantage she could give him. She had managed to furnish the small one-bedroom apartment with hand-me-down furniture and what she found on the sidewalk on Tuesday nights, when people left out big furniture items they didn't want for garbage pickup the next morning. It was always a treasure hunt. She had found her night tables that way, a blue dresser, and the kitchen table they ate on every day. The formica was chipped around the edges, but the bright red looked cheerful in their tiny kitchen, barely big enough for her to cook in. She had painted the walls and some of the furnishings herself, and found the living room rug at Goodwill. All put together, it looked homey and cozy, and she had framed the Spider-Man posters Toby loved for their bedroom, and there was one of Batman and Robin over their bed. Bernice was a single mother. Toby's father had taken off when she got pregnant at 19. She had been working as a waitress by day and going to City College of New York by night. She hadn't seen him since, although she'd heard that he was married now and had 3 other children. She wanted no contact with him. He'd been a smooth talker. She'd fallen for him, and the pregnancy was an accident. He had disappeared as fast as he could. She'd had Toby when she was 20, and had managed parenthood on her own ever since. Bernice was a survivor. More than that, she wanted to make something of herself and set an example for her son, to show him that he didn't have to be limited by the world he was born into, and with an education, he could have a good job and a good life one day. It was what she aspired to herself. She'd been raised in foster homes after her parents died when she was in her early teens. Some of the homes were awful, and some of them were okay, but she was determined that nothing like it would ever happen to her boy. Bernice's only relative, her brother Clive, had been in and out of prison for 12 years since he turned 18, for credit card fraud, grand theft auto, and drug dealing, all the means of making a living he had learned on the streets. She hadn't seen him since she was 16, and he was 20, fresh out of prison on parole. She didn't want to see him again, and he knew nothing about his nephew. Clive wasn't an evil man, and he'd been nice to her, to the best of his ability. He just didn't know how to get out of the trap he had grown up in. She wanted her life and her son's to be different. The building they lived in was clean, and lived in by respectable families on 125th Street. It had been built in the 1930s and must have been beautiful then. What had once been spacious, handsome apartments had been broken into small ones for low rents. Now it was shabby, and the people who had lived there and could had moved downtown. Other buildings near her had been renovated, and parts of her neighborhood were slowly becoming gentrified. She had been fortunate to find an apartment she could afford on her salary. She managed to get by and take care of her son. After graduating from City College, she had worked for TSA Security at JFK International Airport for the past 5 years, checking passengers as they came through the lines, observing them keenly, directing them to the body scan machines, and doing pat-downs when instructed to do so. She was also enrolled in law school online. In Bernice's mind, the secret to everything was education and hard work, and no one was going to cheat her of that. She reminded Toby of it every day, whenever she could. She hated to leave his small, warm body curled up against her back as she got out of bed and headed to the shower to get ready for work. When she left at 4 o'clock, she would leave him with her neighbor, who would take him to school with her own children. Bernice worked a 5:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. shift, which gave her just enough time to pick Toby up at school herself and be with him for the rest of the day. She taught him the extra lessons he didn't have at school yet, and then did her own homework for law school after she made dinner and put him to bed. She tried to be asleep by 9:30 or 10, since she had to get up at 3:30 to get ready for work. She ate breakfast on the train to save time. She didn't go out with friends and hadn't been to a movie in years. Her whole life was her son, her job, and her studies, so that one day they'd have more than that, and he would have a real future. They talked about it a lot, even though he was only 6. She talked to him like an adult and told him she was going to be a lawyer and work in a law firm downtown when she graduated. That was her dream, and dreams became realities if you worked hard enough to achieve them. She said it to Toby almost like a mantra. She showered, had a cup of coffee, and put on her uniform. Bernice was African-American. She was a pretty woman and wore her hair in neat braids tied at the nape of her neck. She had a slim figure and watched her weight, and looked nice in the TSA uniform. Several men she worked with had asked her on dates, many of them married, and she always turned them down. She'd gone out briefly with one of her single male colleagues right after she started working for TSA. It hadn't turned out well, and she hadn't made that mistake again. She hadn't had a serious date in years, or even a casual one in the last two. There would be plenty of time for that, she told herself, when she had a better job after law school. She didn't love working for TSA, but it paid the rent and bought their food, and gave her the time she needed to study for her law classes. Her schedule was good for her. When she was dressed, she rolled Toby, still asleep, into his Spider-Man sleeping bag, carried him to the neighbors, and knocked. She didn't ring the bell, so she wouldn't wake the other children. They didn't have to be in school until 8 o'clock. Toby woke up in his mother's arms just before the door opened. "Why do we have to get up so early?" he complained, burrowing against her and closing his eyes again. It was still dark outside, and would be for several hours. "Because I have to go to work and do my job," she said, kissing his forehead. "And you have to go to school so that one day you can have a good job, too, like a doctor or a lawyer," she added, programming him early. "I want to be a policeman," he grumbled as the door opened, and their neighbor took him in her arms and smiled at Bernice. She knew what a good mother she was and admired her for it. Toby was almost back to sleep as Bernice handed him off. He had a few more hours to doze before he had to get up, have breakfast, and get dressed for school. "Have a nice day," their neighbor whispered and gently closed the door. She took Toby in every morning for free, as a favor to Toby's mother. On weekend nights, Bernice often babysat her two children in exchange, and let them sleep on her couch or in the bed with Toby, and slept on the couch herself, if their mother had a big date. They did what they could to help each other, two women alone with their children. The neighbor had a son and a daughter, close to Toby's age, and the three children were best friends, which worked well, too. It was a beautiful May morning as Bernice left the building, and she thought of the church day camp she had enrolled Toby in for the summer. There would be lots of things for him to do there. She had saved enough money to pay for it by skipping lunch for 5 months. The money was in her bank account now, and they had already accepted him. Bernice rushed to catch the first train she took to work every day, and arrived at the airport right on time. She put her purse in her locker and reported for duty at JFK Airport on the dot at 5:30 a.m. She didn't love her job, but it was a good means to an end, and she reminded herself daily that it wouldn't be forever. Once she graduated from law school, she'd have better opportunities and could look for a job in a law firm, even as a paralegal until she passed the bar. But for now, her daily work life was rife with petty jealousies, unpleasant supervisors, and angry passengers who didn't want to take their shoes off and complained when Bernice had to go through their bags looking for computers or liquids or because of something they'd seen on the X-ray, like a can of dog food or a suspicious object, which in most cases turned out to be nothing when they checked. They were trained to look for weapons, materials that could be combined to create explosives, or whatever seemed suspicious on the X-ray screen. Her current supervisor, Denise Washington, was particularly disagreeable, and it was obvious that she disliked Bernice and everything she stood for. Bernice was too clean-cut and too straight-arrow, and had made the mistake of casually saying one day that she was going through law school online. Denise had been scornful and angry toward her ever since. She hated girls like Bernice, who talked about their bright future as though it were something they could just pluck off a tree. Denise knew better. She had been passed over for promotions for years, and she didn't even care why anymore. In her mind, she was always getting screwed over by some ambitious young woman like Bernice, desperate to get ahead, whatever it took. She was fed up with women like her, had singled Bernice out years before and treated her with contempt. Bernice had thought of complaining to Denise's superior, but knew it wouldn't do any good, and she was sure it would make things worse. Denise was an angry, bitter woman. She talked about Bernice behind her back, just loud enough for her to hear. She hated her job and had never done anything to try to change it. She took out her resentment and frustrations on the people she supervised. Bernice was used to the snide remarks and overt insults, and Denise's obvious disapproval of her. She was jealous of Bernice, although she could have done the same things herself if she had any interest. Bernice took her assigned spot in the security area, while Denise glared at her as usual. Bernice turned her attention to the early passengers heading for their flights, putting their belongings into plastic bins to pass them through the X-ray machine, and then going through the metal detectors and full body scan in stockings or bare feet. She saw the first flight crew roll through in uniform minutes after she got there, and noticed that, judging by the stripes on her uniform, a woman in the group was the pilot, which made Bernice smile. She liked to see that. She thought she got a glimpse of a famous movie star, Susan Farrow, but she might have been mistaken. The woman was older than Bernice would have expected, with oversized dark glasses, which made her hard to recognize. She was pleasant to everyone and was dressed simply in blue jeans and a sweater. She wasn't glamorous, but seemed like a nice person, as Bernice watched her. It was one of the things she liked about her job. You never knew who you would see or what to expect on any given day. It was a pleasant distraction, and made putting up with her nasty supervisor easier to bear. Helen Smith woke up at 4:30, to give herself time to shower and dress, have coffee, and be fully awake by the time she and the others left the Midtown Hotel where the flight crews of their airline stayed in New York. There was no traffic at that hour, so she could leave the hotel at 5:30 in the van that came to get them and be at the airport at 6:30. And there would be little for Helen to attend to once they got there. The airplane planned the routes for them and checked the weather. All she and the rest of her flight crew had to do was make sure that everything was mechanically in order once they were on the plane before they took off. Helen had had a distinguished career as a pilot, and after years as an Air Force fighter pilot, she had been flying for the airline for 2 years. They had been the hardest years of her life. She had a text when she woke up informing her of an equipment change, the second one relating to this flight back to San Francisco. The day before, she had been notified that she'd be flying an Airbus A380 they had on the ground in New York after a flight from London, because it needed to get to San Francisco for a flight to Tokyo. The largest Airbus, the A380, didn't normally fly between San Francisco and New York, but she was checked out for it, and was looking forward to flying it. During the night, they had discovered a mechanical problem on the A380, and couldn't use it for the San Francisco flight after all. They had almost 300 passengers booked for the flight, and had decided to use a new, smaller Airbus A321 for the 8 a.m. to San Francisco, and a Boeing 757 they had available for the overflow, which would take off at 8:20, so the passengers would be happy, could stick to their schedules, and no one would get bumped due to the change of equipment. It meant they needed a second crew for the 757. Helen had been assigned the A321, which was a plane she liked to fly. It was small and easy to maneuver, and the crews liked the aircraft too. The text message she received said that she would be flying with the San Francisco crew, returning to home base as planned. The only change was of the co-pilot, to Jason Andrews, whom she didn't know. They informed her that Captain Connor Gray would be flying deadhead, which meant he would be flying as a courtesy passenger. He would be traveling in the cockpit with her since the flight was full and every passenger seat was sold. The text said only that he had been deactivated and retired due to a medical incident on the ground after his flight to New York 2 days before. The formalities of his retirement would happen in the coming days, but he was no longer cleared to fly, and after the incident wouldn't be again. The airline and FAA were strict about grave medical issues. She'd heard of him as one of the airline's senior pilots, but they had never met. He was close to retirement age, though maybe not quite there yet, and whatever had occurred must have been serious for them to deactivate and retire him summarily halfway through a trip. She thought about it, and hoped to make his return to home base as pleasant as possible under the circumstances. Flying with an unfamiliar co-pilot was standard fare for any commercial pilot, since the crews were varied and interchangeable. It made no difference to her. Some were easy to get along with, others were less pleasant, but all were skilled pilots on the first-rate airline she worked for. She flew the plane she was given to fly, just like in the military, and after years of training and experience, she could fly anything they handed her with her eyes closed. She loved her job. Flying was in her blood. Her father had been an Air Force pilot and retired as a full colonel. Helen had been a fighter pilot for the Air Force in Iraq for several years. She and her husband had both served there, and they had decided that she would leave the Air Force and return to civilian life before his last tour ended. They both had offers from commercial airlines, and, for the sake of their children, thought it was time to muster out. It had been a big adjustment for her. She had grown up in the military, and everything about civilian life was unfamiliar to her. It was difficult at first with her husband still in the Air Force. He had been killed 4 months after she left, 8 weeks before he was due to fly home. She wasn't bitter about what had happened to him. He had been shot down and taken prisoner, and he and all of his crew were killed in an incident that had received press and cries of outrage from around the world. He had been decorated posthumously by the president, and the medal he'd been given was on their mantelpiece in Petaluma, where she and her children lived, less than an hour outside San Francisco, in a small, slightly dilapidated house. She had been in shock over her husband's death at first, and it had an unreal quality to it. They both knew the risks, but she never expected it to happen to him, and she had no idea how to manage civilian life without him. She had thought about re-enlisting after he died, and going back to the only life she knew in the Air Force, but it wouldn't be fair to the children. They had wanted them to experience life outside the military, but not without their father. That had never been the plan. Her own father had done everything he could to help her and stayed with the kids when she was away. A year and a half later, she was still adjusting to civilian life without Jack. It hadn't been easy for her or the kids. It was much harder than she expected, and infinitely more so as a widow. She was 42 years old, and the Air Force and military life were second nature to her. There was some resistance to her being a female pilot with the airline, but others had broken that barrier before her, and most of the men she flew with respected her for her flying record, particularly those who knew of her tours of duty in Iraq. Flying Airbuses between San Francisco and New York or internationally was a piece of cake. She had 5 days off coming to her when she got back to San Francisco and had promised to take all three of her children camping. They were just a regular family now, or tried to be, with two sons in middle school and a 7-year-old daughter, even though their father had been a war hero and their mother had been a fighter pilot. Helen hadn't made many friends in the community yet. She had little in common with the other mothers she had met at school, and she kept to herself or spent her time off with her children. She had to be mother and father to them now, which was double the work with two boys in Little League and a daughter in Girl Scouts and taking hip-hop dance lessons after school. Helen questioned her decision often about leaving the military. There were times when she missed it desperately. It had been like leaving the womb. Everything about civilian life had been a shock at first. She had found that the only time she was comfortable in her own skin and felt like she knew what she was doing was when she was flying. The rest of the time, she felt like a fish out of water. She hadn't learned to be a civilian yet, but she was trying. She was living day by day. What had happened to Jack had taught her that you couldn't count on the future or on anything. Life was a game of chance. She had nothing and no one to believe in now, except herself. And there were times when she felt like she wasn't enough for her kids. The boys especially needed their father, and all she could do now was her best, which wasn't always enough. Nancy Williams lay awake long before the alarm went off, trying to force herself to stay in bed until 5. She had gone to sleep knowing what she was going to do the minute she woke up. It had only dawned on her the day before that she might be pregnant. After 12 years of infertility treatments and 8 attempts at IVF, she and her husband had finally given up and had filed papers to adopt a little girl in China. She was 2 years old, and they were going to Beijing soon to pick her up. They could hardly wait. And suddenly, the day before, on the flight from San Francisco, it had occurred to her that she might be pregnant, without hormone shots or harvesting her eggs this time. It seemed too good to be true. She had gone to a drugstore near the hotel that night to pick up a test kit. It was sitting on the bathroom sink, waiting for her to use it. She was afraid to be disappointed again. At 38, she had been down this path too many times, and crushing disappointment had become a way of life. At 5 a.m., she couldn't stand it anymore. Wide awake, she threw back the covers, headed to the bathroom, and told herself she didn't care. Soon they would have an adopted daughter, so it didn't matter. Except it did. If humanly possible, they still wanted a baby of their own. She hadn't even told her husband her suspicions, not wanting to get his hopes up. He was a pilot for the same airline, had flown to Miami the day before, and was coming back to San Francisco that day, too. She used the test and left it on the sink to work its magic, hopped into the shower, let the hot water run down her face, and got out of the shower faster than she would have otherwise. She had to know, one more time, and when she looked, she let out a scream and held the test in her shaking hand. Two pink lines. She was pregnant, without assistance. It had just happened. All their earlier attempts had been futile. And what were they going to do now about the little girl in China? A thousand thoughts ran through her mind as she sat down on the floor, feeling dizzy, still holding the test kit. She was pregnant at last. Their dream had finally come true. Joel McCarthy was just getting out of the shower when his cell phone rang. He was rushing and had overslept by a few minutes. He recognized the number immediately, and his face broke into a broad smile. He was a tall, dark-haired, handsome man, had done some modeling in his youth, and loved his job as a flight attendant. "What are you doing up at this hour?" he asked his partner, Kevin. "It's 2 in the morning for you." Kevin was at the apartment in San Francisco. "I can't sleep. All I can think about is Friday." "I know. Me too." Both men smiled, and there was a moment of silence between them. Joel was 34, and his partner was 40, and a doctor. They had met on one of Joel's flights 2 years ago and had been together ever since. They were getting married in 2 days, with a small circle of friends around them, and Kevin's parents, who were coming up from Los Angeles. Joel hadn't told his ultra-conservative parents in Utah, nor his 5 brothers and sisters, even his 1 brother who was gay and had never told their parents either. None of them had ever been willing to face the reality of Joel's life, and expecting them to celebrate his marriage to a man would be too much for them. Kevin would be his family now. Joel loved his own family, but they were unable to accept him. He had spent years in therapy dealing with it, and he was finally at ease in his own life. Marrying Kevin was the most wonderful thing that had ever happened to him. "My parents arrived tonight," Kevin told him, sounding euphoric. "My mother is even more excited than we are." Both Kevin's parents had welcomed Joel into their family, and his sister and her husband were just as warm. They were the family Joel had always dreamed of. They were going to Tahiti on their honeymoon. Kevin was a successful plastic surgeon, and had asked Joel to consider giving up his job. But Joel didn't want to be dependent on him and was going to continue flying, at least for a while, maybe until they adopted a child or found a surrogate for their own. Joel was already living in Kevin's apartment, and they were going to start looking for a house to buy when they got back from Tahiti. And they had just gotten a dog. Joel loved all the evidence of domestic life. "I've got to go. I'm going to be late," Joel told him when he saw the time. "I love you. I'll see you tonight. I'll have dinner ready when you get home." "My parents want to take us out," Kevin told him quickly. "Go back to bed and get some sleep, or you'll be exhausted on Friday," Joel said, smiling. All either of them could think of was their wedding. They'd had fun planning it for months. "Have a safe flight," Kevin said before he hung up. He always said that, which touched Joel. He'd never been on a flight that had a problem, but Kevin was nervous about him flying and was a fearful flyer himself. Joel was smiling as he put on his steward's uniform, thinking about Kevin and how lucky he felt to be marrying him, and he was in a great mood when he got in the van with the crew. There were muted greetings of good morning as everyone kept to themselves at that hour. Joel didn't know them all, though he had seen most of them on the flight 2 days before. "They've switched us to an A321 and added a 757 to make up the difference," the captain, Helen Smith, said in a matter-of-fact tone, which caused some comment in the group about the equipment change and breaking it into two flights. Most of them were sorry not to be flying the A380, which they all liked, although they would have had more passengers to deal with on the bigger plane, and the A321 would be easier for the flight attendants. "They're using a New York-based crew for the 757, Captain Smith added, as they waited for the co-pilot to come out of the hotel. She glanced at her watch. He was late. Joel and Nancy chatted quietly while they waited. Nancy was elated after what she'd discovered, but tried not to show it. She didn't want to share the news with anyone until she told her husband, and Joel had been excited all week. This was his last scheduled flight before the wedding. There were two very senior female flight attendants in the van who had been assigned to first class on the trip out, and Joel assumed they would be again. One of them, Jennifer, was the chief purser. They were competent and experienced at tending to demanding first-class passengers, but made it obvious that they didn't enjoy it. Nancy had commented on it to Joel on the flight to New York. She could never see the point of staying in the job once you felt that way, and a number of their older colleagues were visibly tired and bitter. They'd done it for too long, and the vagaries of the passengers they dealt with annoyed them. There was an edge to how they spoke to people, and an attitude you could sense the moment you saw them. Nancy hated working with women like that. They fulfilled the passengers' requests, but only to the degree they had to. And she hoped she wouldn't be working with either of them today. They were conferring quietly about their trips to Hong Kong and Beijing the following month, while the two younger members of the crew, Bobby and Annette, had been assigned to coach before and probably would be again. Annette was whispering to Bobby about a date she'd had the night before, and they both laughed as Helen looked at her watch again with a stern expression. She glanced over then and noticed the older pilot in the van, and realized it was Connor Gray, the newly retired pilot due to fly home with them. She waited until he looked her way and then smiled at him. He nodded in response with a somber expression. He had recognized her, too, and knew her military history. Helen thought Captain Gray looked subdued and somewhat pale, and whatever his medical issue had been after the flight out, Helen got the feeling that he was depressed about it, which wouldn't have been surprising with an immediate forced retirement after the incident. He said nothing to the rest of the crew, nor to her. And then, finally, the co-pilot they'd been waiting for jumped into the van with no apology for the delay. He was strikingly handsome, with blonde movie star looks, and acted as though he were playing a part. He introduced himself as Jason Andrews and immediately complained about the equipment change, and said he'd been looking forward to flying the A380 since he had recently qualified for it. And then he looked at Helen with a sarcastic expression as the van took off for the airport. "Girls' flight today?" he commented as Connor Gray glared at him with blatant disapproval for his lack of respect for Captain Smith. As the van threaded its way between several trucks, Jason Andrews made it clear that he thought female pilots were second-rate at best. The rest of the crew members were shocked into silence. Helen said nothing and didn't care. She had met many men like him in the Air Force, who disliked female pilots, and it didn't faze her at all. He was obviously a smart aleck, full of himself, and was wearing his uniform hat at a rakish angle. When they got out at JFK, he made a comment about how hot Bobby was. Bobby heard him say it and told him she was married, as they collected their bags out of the van, and he looked at her with a roguish smile. "And the problem is?" he countered to Bobby, and then focused on Nancy, who was a tall, attractive blonde with a good figure. He seemed to think that all women were easy prey for him, and his for the picking. Nancy ignored him and chatted quietly with Joel as they rolled their bags into the airport. The co-pilot had made no friends on the trip out. The two older flight attendants looked right through him, and Bobby whispered to Annette that he was a jerk. He had managed to rub everyone the wrong way with his snide comments on the drive to the airport. He made another remark Helen didn't like as they moved to the head of the security line and put their computers, cell phones, and minor belongings in the plastic bins and their rolling bags on the moving belt to be X-rayed. "Welcome to the heart of Africa," Jason said under his breath, just loud enough for the others to hear, and anyone standing nearby, as he glanced at the TSA agents around them, most of whom were African Americans. "Watch that," Captain Helen Smith said in a sharp tone that reminded them all of her military background. She was wide awake and quick to call him on it, although she'd been quiet in the van. "You're part of my crew now, Andrews, until we land at SFO. I can write you up for that remark, or suspend you," she said bluntly, as a particularly pretty young TSA agent watched the exchange and had heard the comment. The co-pilot seemed like a jerk to her, too. Bobby's assessment of him seemed apt. "You must have heard me wrong, Captain," he said with mock respect. "I hope I did. Make sure I don't hear you wrong again." He didn't respond, and followed the rest of the crew as they walked toward their gate. The two planes for the flights to San Francisco, leaving 20 minutes apart, were parked next to each other. The San Francisco crew members were joined by a full crew from New York, who had been added for the 757. They were separated quickly and went to their respective planes. On the A321, the flight attendants met with Jennifer, the chief purser, once they were on board, to get their cabin assignments, which, as Joel had guessed, were the same as the flight out. Helen, Jason, and the now-retired Connor Gray headed for the cockpit to settle in. Jason gave Joel a contemptuous look as he walked past, but he didn't say a word. He didn't need to. His scorn for Joel was in his eyes. Helen sat down in the captain's seat and turned to talk to Connor Gray for a few minutes. She seemed to relax and warm up once she was in the cockpit. It was home to her. Nothing ever felt as good to her as flying a plane. She had all-American looks, with light brown hair, an intelligent face, and bright blue eyes that took in everything. And Connor looked more at ease and brightened while they talked. He explained to her in a low voice that he had a brief cerebral incident, a TIA. The doctors had said it might never happen again, but it could. It lasted only a few seconds, during which he didn't recognize his surroundings, but his career had ended on the spot. If it had happened while he was flying the plane, it could have been disastrous. "I'm really sorry," she said sympathetically, and he thanked her. He had enormous respect for her, not just professionally, but personally. Like most of the world, he had seen her husband murdered by his captors on TV. It had been horrifying, and something no one could forget. Connor didn't refer to it, but told her it was an honor to fly with her on his final flight in uniform. She said the same about him, and he could see that she was sincere. She seemed like a kind woman, in addition to her reputation as a highly skilled pilot. Jason took the co-pilot seat while they were talking, and paid no attention to either of them. He checked some of the equipment and gauges and then started texting. As she watched him, Helen had the feeling that she was flying with a giant spoiled brat for their flight home. He was young and cocky, and his arrogance annoyed her, although she didn't show it. After chatting with Connor, she made her initial checks, called the tower about their flight plan, and was satisfied that everything was in order. She thought it was a good thing that they had accommodated the passengers with two flights, instead of leaving half of them stranded when the A380 couldn't fly. The second flight was boarding at the same time. Helen was pleased to have the A321. It was a recent model and enjoyable to fly. The 757 was an older plane and not as comfortable for the passengers, and she had been told by air traffic control that the weather looked good all the way across the country. She looked at both men with a broad smile. She was in her element. "Well, gentlemen, it looks like we're going to have a nice, easy ride home." Connor nodded, and she could see the sadness in his eyes. Jason looked straight at her and held her gaze for a long moment, as though challenging her, shrugged, and went back to texting. Helen started the engines then, made an announcement to the passengers that they'd be pushing back from the gate shortly, and assured them of a smooth flight to San Francisco and possibly an early arrival. She had a feeling it was going to be a very nice day. It was off to a good start. Chapter 2 Bernice watched the passengers for both San Francisco flights file through security after the crew. There were flights leaving for all over the country, and she noticed the last passengers in a hurry to get to their planes. There was a young father with a baby who looked totally disorganized. He was juggling a diaper bag that had clothes pouring out of it, several bottles and sippy cups, a teddy bear, disposable diapers, and a pacifier in his hand. He had another bag with his computer. He dropped his cell phone twice, and he looked as though he wasn't used to managing a baby on his own. There was a couple arguing while they put their sweaters and shoes in plastic bins and made nasty comments to each other. And a well-dressed, somewhat uptight-looking businesswoman with a large briefcase, who appeared to be about 40 years old and seemed as though she could run the world. Bernice could see that she was anxious, despite her competent corporate look. She had well-cut blonde hair and was wearing an expensive beige suit and high heels. Bernice could easily imagine her going straight to a meeting of some kind. She snapped at two of the TSA agents that they were going to make her miss her flight if they didn't hurry up when they checked her briefcase. Bernice smiled to her only friend at work as the woman went through and headed toward the gates for San Francisco. "That one's a nervous flyer for sure," Bernice said in a whisper. "How do you know?" Della asked her. She'd only worked there for a year. She was small and round, and passengers like the businesswoman always intimidated her. Bernice had seen it all 1,000 times in the last 5 years. "The nervous flyers always act like that," she said coolly. "Then they get on the flight and get drunk or take a Xanax." Both young women laughed. After they had watched the well-dressed blonde grab her briefcase, shove her computer into it, grab her cell phone, put on her shoes, and hurry toward the gate for her flight. It was early in the morning, and she already looked stressed. There were a large number of businessmen who were obviously experienced travelers and went through security without a problem. As they watched them head for the San Francisco gate, Della commented to Bernice that it would be a good flight to catch a man. She had been looking to meet someone for a while, after breaking up with her boyfriend. But the men she was talking about were all too old for her, as Bernice pointed out, and shook her head. "Look at their left hands," Bernice said. "Wedding rings. They're all married." She was a pro at assessing passengers. "Maybe they cheat," Della said hopefully. "Oh, there's a dream come true. A married guy cheating on his wife. I'll pass on that," Bernice said without regret. "Maybe they divorced their wives," she commented naively. "No, thank you." Bernice turned away to find herself in the direct field of vision of their supervisor, who was scowling at them, as usual. "Now there's a woman who desperately needs to get laid," Della whispered, and the two of them tried not to laugh. 5 minutes after the nervous woman in the expensive suit and high heels, Bernice noted a Middle Eastern-looking couple taking off their shoes and putting them in the bins, with their computers. They were a pleasant, quiet man and a simply dressed young woman, somewhere in their 20s, and Bernice watched them, as she had everyone else. The woman was wearing a headscarf, with a long gray cotton coat covering her clothes. He was in jeans. They both had on running shoes, like most travelers their age, and he was carrying a leather backpack. She noticed Bernice looking at them and smiled at her, and the man seemed in a hurry to catch their flight then and was rushing his wife along. Bernice was still watching hand luggage pass through the X-ray when they collected their belongings on the other side and sped off toward the first San Francisco gate. Earlier, there had been a group of about 14 girls who were part of a girls' chorus from Queens, and their heavy-set blonde chaperone kept shrieking their names in a high-pitched voice and threatening to call their parents. They said they were going to San Francisco for a performance and had won a competition, and the girls looked to be a range of ages from about 9 to 15. They were all wearing sweatshirts that identified them as from their chorus. They were far better behaved than their chaperone, who got in an argument with a TSA agent about cosmetics she had brought with her that were in bottles over the size limit and had to be taken from her. She wrote down the agent's name and said she would report her. There was always someone like that. But the girls were having fun, laughing and squealing and teasing each other. They watched two children with their tearful mother then, handing them over to a ground agent to fly unaccompanied on the flight. She put ribbons around their necks with badges on them, which identified them as unaccompanied minors. The ground agent looked desperate to get away from the mother before she fell apart completely, after she had kissed them 10 times. The little boy and girl were much less upset than she was, and they waved as they went through security, and then disappeared toward the gate as their mother sobbed, and Bernice said a kind word to her. "I know that must be hard," she said gently, "but they'll be fine. They'll have a great time on the flight. They can watch movies. They're only 6 and 8, and this is the first time I've ever sent them anywhere alone. They're going to see my parents. I just got divorced," she said, and lost it. "My husband left me." Bernice handed her some tissues, and the woman thanked her. "I have a 6-year-old son, too," Bernice volunteered, as though it gave her credibility. "Then you know how tough this is." The woman couldn't stop crying, and Bernice felt sorry for her. "They'll be fine," Bernice repeated gently, and the woman finally left. As soon as she did, Denise, her supervisor, sidled up to her with a look of displeasure. "Always kissing ass on someone, aren't you, Adams?" she said nastily, and Bernice shrugged and walked away. She had long since given up trying to reason with her, or win her over, or get a fair shake from her. She never did. The woman hated her, and there was nothing she could do about it. There was a lull, then, after the early flights took off, that would get people to other cities in time for lunch or meetings that day. The 2 San Francisco flights were due to land at 11 a.m. and 11:20 a.m. Pacific time. Bernice had nothing to do, so she went to stack the empty plastic bins on a cart, where the next wave of passengers could grab them easily, and the whole process would start again. Although the people were always different, the routine was still the same. She was stacking the containers, thinking about the homework she had to do that night, when she noticed a large postcard, a photo of the Golden Gate Bridge, that had been left in one of the bins. She picked it up, and when she turned it over, someone had scrawled across the whole back of the card, "You will remember me forever." It sounded more like an order than a statement. It didn't sound romantic, like a message from a lover, but there was nothing unusual about the card. She assumed it had slipped out of someone's coat or purse or briefcase going through the X-ray machine, and it had been forgotten in the bin. She picked it up to throw it away and walked over to the trash can, and something stopped her as she looked at it again and noticed that the word "forever" was heavily underlined. There was something so emphatic about it, but maybe it was a love note of some kind, after a particularly memorable night or weekend. She was going to put it in the trash and then slipped it into a drawer instead. She didn't know why, but she felt as though she should save it, although that didn't make much sense. There was nothing remarkable about it, and it wasn't a threat. She got busy doing other things then and forgot about it. She pushed the cart of empty bins to the head of the line, and the postcard slipped her mind as things got busy again, and she stood there telling people to take off their shoes and take their computers out of their bags and place them in the bins. One thing she didn't like about her job was having to repeat herself all day long, and how annoyed people got when they didn't like what she said. When the Muslim couple handed in their boarding cards at the gate, they were told to step aside and wait for a moment. The young man looked surprised and displeased, and the woman said something to calm him down, while he grumbled that they would miss their flight. "They're singling us out," he said unhappily, as the agent walked away. "You don't know that, Ahmed," his wife Sadaf told him calmly. "And can you blame them? It's safer for all of us if they're careful and check everyone out." He looked seriously annoyed to have to wait as a ground agent returned. "I have good news," the ground agent announced to them, with a smile that nothing could dampen. even the dissatisfied-looking customer. Coach is oversold on your flight because of the change of aircraft. We're moving some people up to business class, and we've upgraded you, free of charge. She beamed as though she were telling them they'd won the lottery. The man looked hesitant and conferred in a whisper with his wife, who appeared to scold him in response, and then she turned to the ground agent politely. "Thank you. We accept." She took the two new boarding passes they were offered, and they walked down the jetway to the plane, still speaking quietly to each other. They had been polite during the entire exchange, but he continued to look ill at ease once they found their seats and sat down looking as though he was sulking. They noticed that the door to the cockpit was open and glanced past first class with interest, as the woman across the aisle from them in the beige business suit suddenly noticed them. Catherine James was the woman who Bernice had guessed correctly was a nervous flyer, and they both could read on her face that she was now convinced there were terrorists on the plane. At that exact moment, a flight attendant walked past them with a tray of orange juice and glasses of champagne. Catherine James grabbed two of the champagnes and drained them both with a look of panic. The young couple politely declined both juice and wine as the husband finally began to relax. The seats were comfortable. They were seated together, and there was a movie screen in front of each of them. The woman looked delighted at their good luck to be upgraded, and he smiled too. Catherine James stopped staring at them then, and noticed that the man seated next to her was scrutinizing her, and she looked embarrassed. "I don't normally drink at this hour," she said uncomfortably. "I'm a nervous flyer," she explained. The man observing her was wearing a business suit and a tie, had paid for a Wi-Fi connection, and was already sending emails, which encouraged her to take her computer out, too. The champagne had made her feel calm enough to think about work. Her seatmate didn't say a word to her in response, and he wondered if he was going to be next to a hysterical drunk for the entire flight. It wasn't a cheering prospect. He had work to do. She glanced at him repeatedly, and he finally said something to her. "This is one of the safest planes in the sky," he assured her, and she looked unconvinced. And with that, a steward came by with more champagne, and Catherine took another glass and drained that one, too. The man in the business suit decided to ignore her then, and assumed she'd fall asleep. He went back to his emails, and she did the same. She concentrated on her computer, and looked a little less panicked after the glasses of champagne. The flight attendants were all setting up their galleys and getting organized to serve breakfast, while the passengers put away their hand luggage and settled into their seats. Every seat on the flight was taken, and a number of people from coach had been upgraded into business class. Not just the young couple across from Catherine, but several businessmen, and the two unaccompanied children as well. The captain came on the PA system then, introduced herself, thanked them for their patience with the equipment changes, and wished them a good flight. She said they would be ready to leave as soon as everyone had taken their seats. And with that, Catherine looked panicked again and commented to her seatmate. "Oh, God, the pilot is a woman," she said anxiously, and he smiled. "Some of the best pilots are women. I saw her when the crew came on. She looks very competent to me," he said, and they both went back to work. Catherine tried to focus on her emails. She was going to San Francisco for a big meeting and interview in Silicon Valley, and she had to get to work, whether the pilot was a woman or not. But by then, the three glasses of champagne had worked their magic, and she nodded over her computer and fell asleep. The man next to her shook his head and rolled his eyes as he went back to work. The plane moved away from the gate and headed for the runway, and 10 minutes later, with Catherine still sound asleep, they were in the air, heading for San Francisco. On the ground, there was another momentary lull in security, and the TSA agents stood around and chatted and waited for the next wave of passengers. It reminded Bernice of the postcard she had found in the plastic bin. She took it out of the drawer and studied it again. Was it a message from a lover? A reminder of a great weekend? A warning of some kind? She couldn't decide as she looked at it, but the tone of it seemed harsh, as though ordering the recipient to remember the person who had written the card forever. It lacked tenderness and romance. Or was she making too much of it? And feeling foolish for doing it, she walked over to her supervisor, Denise, and handed it to her. She was standing alone and looking bored as Bernice approached. "What do you think of this?" Bernice asked in an innocent voice. Denise looked at it and shrugged. "It's a postcard. Why?" "I know it's a postcard," Bernice said, trying to be pleasant with her. "I found it in a bin for the X-ray machine. Does it seem ominous to you?"
"Ominous?"
Denise looked at Bernice as though she were stupid.
"What's ominous about it? It just says, 'You'll remember me forever.' The guy who wrote this probably has a 2-foot dick,"
she said and laughed. But Bernice didn't.
"I thought that too at first. But if you read it again, it sounds weird to me. It gives me a creepy feeling."
"Maybe you need to meet this guy," Denise said rudely. "Don't take yourself so seriously. You'll get your next promotion when you're supposed to. You don't need to invent shit to try and get it early. Throw the card away. It's just crap. If we jumped on everything we found, the planes would be grounded here 99% of the time."
Bernice nodded and went to throw the card in the trash, but as her hand hovered over the garbage, she pulled it back, still holding the card. She didn't know why, but something about it was worrying her. She slipped it into her pocket instead and went back to work, as a new wave of passengers began to arrive. Chapter 3 The takeoff of the A321 bound for San Francisco went smoothly in Helen's capable hands. She looked totally at ease, and it was a beautiful morning with cameo blue skies all around them. Once they reached their cruising altitude, she set the plane on autopilot and turned to smile at Jason Andrews and Connor Gray in the cockpit with her. Captain Gray was very somber and hadn't said anything since their brief initial conversation. Helen wondered if he was feeling unwell, but he didn't look ill. He seemed sad. She was about to say something to him when Joel knocked and was buzzed into the cockpit with coffee for all three of them and cinnamon rolls that smelled delicious. Jason took one and didn't thank him, and gave Joel an ugly look. Joel was courteous and pleasant and said before he left that their breakfast would be ready soon.
"I can't stand guys like that," Jason said as soon as the door closed behind him, and Helen gave him a disapproving look. "They think they own the world now. They make me sick."
"You seem to have a problem with a number of groups," she said sternly. "Female pilots, African Americans, homosexuals. That's a pretty limited view of the world. I take it you've never been in the military, Andrews. You have to learn to live with a lot of different people there. Or anywhere these days. It must be hard for you, with all these people you don't like to deal with." He didn't respond to what she said, but had a smirk on his face. Connor Gray was watching him closely and admired how unruffled the captain remained. "What's your beef with female pilots?" she asked Jason, curious whether his prejudices were based on a negative experience or his own bad attitude. The latter seemed more likely.
"Depends on how you fly the plane," Jason said boldly. "But the fools who run our precious airline wouldn't let you fly if you weren't good at what you do, I guess,"
he conceded grudgingly. He wasn't afraid to offend her, but it didn't bother her. She looked calm and easygoing as she listened. He had eyes that were filled with resentment, despite his boyish good looks.
"Generally, I think men make better pilots, but I guess some women are okay," he admitted. "Your takeoff was pretty smooth just now."
He was incredibly arrogant, had a superior attitude, and seemed to have an axe to grind against everyone.
"But this plane is a breeze to fly," he said, mitigating his earlier praise.
"Yes, it is," she said in a friendly tone. "I'll let you land at SFO if you want." It was her prerogative to decide which of them would land, and she could always take over if she didn't like his approach, and the passengers would be safe. She wouldn't have let him land the big Airbus. He didn't have enough hours on it yet, but he was more than adequately qualified for the plane they were flying. There were always some flyboys in aviation who thought that men should own the skies. Fortunately,
Neither the Air Force nor the airline they worked for agreed with him, and she had long since earned her flawless reputation.
"Do you know who you're flying with?"
Connor suddenly spoke up in a deep, angry voice and startled both of them. There was emotion trembling through his words.